All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. And our next guest on the show is Phil Giraldi. He's a former CIA and DIA officer, contributing editor to the American Conservative Magazine, and executive director of the Council for the National Interest Foundation, and, of course, a regular contributor to Antiwar.com. Welcome back to the show, Phil. How's it going?
Okay, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing great. Appreciate you joining us today.
Good.
All right. So, it was funny. Charles Featherstone was on the show, and he was saying the most impressive thing about the Arab Spring to him is how Israel and Al-Qaeda both are so marginal. They have virtually nothing to do with what's going on here. All they can do is just sit around dumbfounded. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that's basically an accurate analysis. This thing is happening all by itself. And I would add to that group, the United States has very little leverage over most of what's going on. So Israel basically has to accept what's going on. Al-Qaeda is a marginal player because, it really is not their agenda. I think that's an accurate assessment.
All right. Now, Al-Qaeda did want the fall of all the American-backed dictatorships in the region, but I guess they assumed that after a decade or so of America waging war over there, that people would be rallied to their cause. And I guess you're saying it just hadn't worked out that way. They want revolutions, but not Al-Qaeda-like ones.
Well, I mean, they're obviously Al-Qaeda has a very specific, longer agenda than just getting rid of these leaders. And I don't think the longer agenda necessarily appeals to the Arab street. So I think that's essentially what Featherstone was saying, and that's what I would say, that the whole Al-Qaeda package has a lot of other loose ends that are not very attractive.
Yeah. Well, yeah, good. I mean, hell, it was pretty obvious. I remember, reading, I forget what now, but it seemed credible at the time, about how after some suicide attacks inside Saudi Arabia in, 2006 or something like that, the poll numbers across Saudi Arabia were, hey, we way prefer the House of Saud to you guys. Forget it if this is how you're going to be.
Yeah, because, basically there is relatively little support. There is some support, but relatively little support among the hoi polloi, among the people in these Muslim countries for suicide bombers and these kinds of attacks. And
I always wondered how to say that. I always just read it.
Ah, okay.
Hoi polloi.
Hoi polloi. It means the people in Greek.
Oh, there you go.
But anyway, there's very little sympathy for it. And basically, people sometimes support the objectives and things like that because they are cognizant of the fact that their governments are corrupt and hopelessly corrupt. And that's part of what Al-Qaeda is saying. But the rest of the package is not appealing.
Right. Now, well, what about these reports about Al-Qaeda in Libya? And they all came, the ones that went to fight as Al-Qaeda in Iraq during the worst of that war against the Americans were all from the East, and these are the guys we're fighting for now. Some so say the neocons, at least.
Yeah, well, there are those stories, but, I'm not so sure to what extent these stories are verifiable. There's they're not only the ones who went to fight in Central Asia or Iraq, of which there are probably very few Libyans, but also, of course, there's been a long time Al-Qaeda affiliate in North Africa in general, which runs all the way over from, Tunis to Mauritania. And they've been very active. They certainly have some presence in more remote areas in Libya. And
how many people you think are part of that?
I don't know. I think we're talking about maybe hundreds or low hundreds. I don't think we're talking about very many people, and I don't think there's any sense of this this rebel movement in any way being influenced by them. I think that's a false assumption. And but of course, that's
what do those guys have to do with Al-Qaeda anyway, really?
It's like McDonald's. They're the franchise. They basically support the agenda that Al-Qaeda has, which is the Salafist agenda. In fact, the Salafist you could argue the Salafist agenda originated in North Africa, originated in Algeria and places like that. And the fact is that they have a certain community of interest, but it doesn't mean that tactically or strategically they operate together.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Is it crazy for me to think that, I don't know, 3 weeks from now, after the Marines invade the place, that there's going to be suicide attacks, and then we're going to have an entire new theater of the war on terror, because this is now the new, you know, as Dick Cheney would say, the geographical center of gravity of where this kind of thing is going on, and we'll use Libya as flypaper to lure all the terrorists there and kill them, and it'll be just like 2004 all over again?
Well, I think you might be right, but I think the reasoning is a little bit different. The thing is, if you read the serious studies that have been done about suicide bombers, Robert Pape at University of Chicago, the indication is that the suicide bombers are a response to occupation. They're not necessarily an al-Qaeda thing.
Yeah, I guess I'm assuming here that the U.S. is going to have to invade eventually to get their way and get rid of Gaddafi.
I think that's a safe bet. I think that it's pretty clear that now that Obama has committed himself to getting rid of Gaddafi, it's clear that the rebels are not going to be able to do it by themselves. So you're going to have to put people in there, whether it's special forces to train the rebels, which could be a long and painful process, or you put your own people in to finish him off more quickly. But these things are never quick, are they?
No, afraid not. It's amazing how quickly they can get into him, but I see nothing but a very ugly chain of cause and effect in front of us here. I wonder if you saw this piece in McClatchy about this guy Khalifa Hifter, who is quite obviously, according to this article by Chris Adams, asset of the CIA. He's a Libyan expat, and the last paragraph reads basically that nobody's sure what this guy does for a living, but he lives in a real nice house in suburban Virginia and has a big family.
Yeah, I did see that article, and I think
he's there now helping lead the rebellion.
Yeah, he's quite likely a CIA person. I would think that he fits the profile, shall we say.
Yeah, well, so I guess, they didn't have to sell a bunch of lies about sarin and mustard gas and whatever to us, right? They just waltzed right in with hardly an excuse at all.
Well, I think that, there certainly are enough good excuses for going against Gaddafi. I mean, Gaddafi did kill a bunch of Americans, Pan Am 101. He killed a bunch of French citizens when he downed a UTA flight around the same time frame. And Gaddafi is a murderous thug. There's no question about it. But the broader issue is, to what extent does the United States have some kind of obligation, or should we be creating this democracy promotion myth, which would feed not only Libya, but it would, you could use the same arguments against Syria. You could use the same arguments against Iran. I don't think they'll use the same arguments against Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, but you certainly could. So the question is, where do you draw the line? When do you stop all this stuff? And once you start, you're on a road that's going to lead to nothing but trouble.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's really, to get back to the original question about the relevance of al-Qaeda in this, if there are ground troops and an occupation in Libya, if there's a massive intervention in Syria, perhaps an invasion of that country, if this thing continues to progress, what's that going to do for the message of Osama bin Laden and his group? Because after all, it seemed his message did seem pretty plausible in a lot of minds over there. It seemed like in 2003 and 4, and maybe it wore thin pretty quick, especially the way they killed so many innocent people in Iraq. Seems like something like this could really give them a boost. We could be just basically spreading his terror war across North Africa, where it didn't exist.
Yeah, well, the fact is, every time we invade another Muslim country, it's propaganda in his favor. There's no question about that. And I think that there was some reluctance on the part of the White House to get too heavily involved in this for that reason. But as we're seeing, they're sliding down the slope right now.
Yeah, they just can't help themselves. What's the point of having this fabulous army if you can't use it?
That's right.
All right, everybody. It's Phil Giraldi. He's a former CIA and DIA officer who writes for the American Conservative and Antiwar.com, and we'll be right back with more of this after this. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. It's Antiwar Radio. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Phil Giraldi from Antiwar.com and the American Conservative magazine. His most recent article is called Neocon Foreign Policy. And this gets to the other part of where we started here, Phil, and that is Israel's relevance or irrelevance here, and It's funny the way this article reads. Basically, it sounds like from at least the neocons in Washington's point of view, and I guess that reflects Likud and Israel pretty well, too. This Arab Spring is all about Persia.
That's right. Obviously, you know, the target that's still on everybody's mind in Washington and also in Tel Aviv is Iran. So you always have to be looking at things in terms of, you know, how they relate to Iran. And I think I didn't say it in the article, but to a certain extent, the article that Iran is the emerging threat is buttressed by all of this stuff, because they're basically, the neocons are saying, look, all these Arab regimes are going down. There's going to be a period of democratization in which they're going to be unstable and weak. And who's going to be the winner from this? It's going to be Iran. So every argument is ultimately turned to make a case for being tougher with Iran.
Yeah, and of course that's what all the heat on Syria is about too.
Sure, that's right. Syria is the surrogate for Iran. Like I commented, I was at a meeting on Monday, and I commented that it's funny how there have been a whole bunch of editorials in the Washington Post and New York Times about getting tough with Syria. And actually, if you look at the numbers, Bahrain has killed more demonstrators than Syria has.
Yeah.
And there's not much out there talking about getting tough with Bahrain. So
yeah, Yemen's much worse than that.
Yeah, and Yemen far worse than either one of them. And so it's a question of they're playing politics with this kind of stuff.
Now, I don't know. I asked this about from Stephen Walt on the show yesterday. I don't know. Maybe it's a failure of my imagination. I guess I screwed up on the Libya thing, too. Is it really possible that they'll invade Syria, that this will end up with a war against Syria and then Iran? Somebody's got to be a cooler head up there. I know Admiral Fallon is gone or whatever, but come on.
Well, you know, it's tough to say. I think that there are a lot of people who are quite aware of the fact that taking on two more wars in that region would be not only unmanageable, it would be disastrous in terms of other consequences. But at the same time, you know, there's a lot of pressure to do it. Netanyahu spoke last week, and he said that if the sanctions currently in place on Iran don't work, then the next step is to attack them. And he even suggested who might attack them. He said the United States should do it. And so this is, you know, this is kind of there. Netanyahu certainly has his own political problems inside Israel, and it's hard to say how long he's actually going to be in charge. But if he's not in charge, he'll be replaced by another nutcase like Avigdor Lieberman. They passed, I guess you know, 2 days ago, this new citizenship law, which will make it relatively easy to disenfranchise Arab citizens of Israel. So, you know, these are extreme nutcases, and there's no question but that they're capable of anything, and they're capable of creating a situation to try to draw the United States into a war. But, you know, at the same time, there are a lot of people, I think, signaling to them that this is not a good idea. I think Admiral Mullen, for example, has had a couple of missions to Israel in which he's privately assured them of American support for their security, but at the same time, they have to ratchet back on the aggressiveness.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it seems like, in a way, maybe I've just been kidding myself, but it seemed like the danger of war with Iran had cooled down, at least for now, sort of thing. Certainly the propaganda against them has over the past few months. But if, you know, what's happening in Syria now turns into a civil war, and then US/UN or some other kind of intervention from the West like that, that seems like the way into war with Iran right there. Maybe no way to stop it after that.
Well, I think that, yeah, there is a certain danger of that. I think the people I know that know Syria very well believe that Assad is essentially unshakable, that these demonstrations will probably lead to some moderation of policies and things like that, but they don't see it going beyond that. But they've been wrong before. They were wrong about the Shah of Iran. They were wrong about Mubarak. Somehow these movements can sometimes develop their own inertia, which can even bring down a dictator.
Yeah, it seems like East Coast types tend to always conflate what they think with what the people think, and, you know, what the elite think with what the people think, and probably That's why they miss a lot of things, right? Popular Revolution out the window, but they're sitting there drinking tea with the local leader and believe everything's fine.
Yeah, when you're having a martini at the Four Seasons, it's your perspective is a little bit different than some Arab guy who's trying to sell oranges so he can feed his family and has a policeman take his oranges away. That's, you know, there are different perspectives.
Yeah. All right, so, you know, there was one article in Haaretz where I think it was Shimon Peres was saying, now this is really problematic that we've lost Egypt because it was always nice to know that if we launched a war with Iran, that our southern flank, we had our pal Mubarak, who was going to keep everything in hand for us. And I guess I have to assume that the Israelis and the Americans are working double shifts to try to, you know, control events in Egypt right now, although I'm not hearing too much about it or reading too much about it anywhere.
Well, it's mostly been a U.S. effort. There have been a number of U.S. military high rollers already that have been over there talking to the Egyptian general staff and everything to try to keep this thing on course. I don't know whether they're going to be successful or not. Clearly, there is a popular sentiment for ratcheting back a bit on the peace treaty with Israel to basically open the border at Rafah to make it easier for the Gazans to pass in and out. So that would certainly be an issue. I'm not quite sure how that's going to go.
Yeah. Does it seem like the protesters are ever going to get their way? It seems like, you know, if their revolution really did make a difference, that blockade at the Gaza Strip would be the first thing to go, and it's still sitting there.
Well, it is and it isn't. I gather that there has been a lot more movement through it. But officially, yeah, it is still there. Bear in mind that this whole thing about Egypt, there's a bit of a misconception. I mean, Egypt is essentially controlled by the military in terms of their penetration in the economy, in terms of their penetration in the political system and everything like that. So this is the winner, no matter who wins ultimately, it's still going to be the military that's calling a lot of the shots. So
yeah, they pretty much just got rid of their pretend civilian president.
That's right, and there'll be another one to replace him, and maybe there will be some liberalization, maybe there won't be. There will be certainly some token liberalizations, but the fact is that the military still calls the shots, and essentially they're going to be looking at in terms of what their interest is. Do we really want to rock the boat with the Americans, or do we want to do this, or do we want to do that? That's the way they're going to see it.
Yeah, and they'll be the ones who decide.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and I forgot where I learned this, but something like 2/3 of Egypt's food resources are imported from the West, and particularly the United States. I mean, they're not going anywhere.
Yeah, that's right. They have basically a problem with a huge population that's growing very fast. They don't have jobs for them. They don't have food for them. And that's not going to change for any government.
Yeah. Although it's getting harder and harder to buy that American food with those inflated dollars, which seems to be at the root of a lot of this revolution in the first place over there.
Well, not only there, but also here.
Yeah. Well, you know, I wonder whether Robert Gates will call for the military to stand down when the American people rise up over the cost of their bread.
That would be an interesting question. Would American soldiers shoot American civilians? The Egyptians refused to do it. I don't know. I don't think we're ever going to see a revolution here because the American people have been so propagandized and cowed that I don't see much of that revolutionary spirit, except on the page of anti-war, of course.
Yeah. Mm.
But, you know, I really don't. I sometimes think, oh, yeah, Ron Paul, Rand Paul, things are going to start moving, but then all of a sudden they grind to a halt.
Yeah, well, you know, it's Murray Rothbard always counseled long-term optimism, because after all, we're right, and, you know, statism doesn't work. This is madness, all this empire building and all the rest of this. But short-term pessimism, because after all, it's a pretty steep uphill battle that we got to fight here. You know, it's a war of ideas that's going to take a long time. That's what Ron Paul's doing is, you know, getting in the minds of people that where hopefully decisions they make, you know, way on out from here will be somewhat informed by, you know, what they learned from him, that kind of thing. That's probably the best we can hope for right now.
Yeah, I think you're right. But, you know, the basic problem is we're like what Sisyphus pushing the stone up the hill.
Yeah.
It keeps rolling back down. That's the problem.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they just waltz right into Libya and go, oh, yeah, well, we're doing this because we're the good guy in the Middle East there to give everybody democracy. You can see all about it on The Daily Show. That's our hypocrisy is we don't invade enough countries to give them freedom.
Right.
And so that proves that we're selfish or whatever. Amazing. All right. Anyway, As usual, you got it straight where everybody else has it back asswards. I appreciate it, Phil.
Okay, thanks, Scott.
That's Phil Giraldi, everybody. Antiwar.com/Giraldi.